Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickert in today for Kathleen Dunn. Happy 4th of July. And on this Independence Day, it's a good time to give a nod to John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. Both of these founding fathers died on the 4th of July, on the same day within hours of one another. This hour, we'll consider men like Adams and Jefferson, presidents who've shaped our country. Of course, they've all been men so far. Our guest this hour examines 11 past presidents and puts his finger on their moments of weakness and how they overcame it, their blunders, their gaffes, their literal fumbling of glasses, and how it may have impacted our country and our country's policy. This hour, Imperfect Presidents, Tales of Misadventure and Triumph. Did Ronald Reagan make the world a safer place, or was he forever tainted by the Iran-Contra affair? Was LBJ the real champion of the civil rights era, despite his poor choices in Vietnam? And why did Thomas Jefferson give John Adams the cold shoulder when it meant destabilizing a nation? Join us this hour as we take a look at presidents of distant and recent past. You can even weigh in on George W. Bush if you'd like to. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Jim Cullen is the author of Imperfect Presidents. He teaches at the Ethical Culture Fieldston School in New York. Jim Cullen, good morning.
Good morning, Veronica.
Thanks so much for taking time out of your Independence Day to talk.
My pleasure.
So let's talk about Ronald Reagan. He's widely revered by conservatives today and grudgingly respected for his political skills by liberals. But even so, the Iran-Contra affair has never really gone away. Tell us about that.
Well, the Iran-Contra affair took place toward the end of Reagan's presidency, and it was a pretty complicated series of events that involved the United States secretly trading arms to Iran through Israel, and this was a pretty serious problem. First of all, because it was illegal under the Constitution, and secondly, it was pretty politically embarrassing because Reagan had come to power as a sort of a tough-minded foreign policy hawk who had said repeatedly that he would never negotiate for hostages, and Iran was, of course, the United States' worst enemy, arguably at this point in American history. Moreover, the sale of the weapons to Iran was used to fund an illegal war in Nicaragua against the Contras. So this was one of the really more serious infractions against the Constitution and a real political disaster for Reagan that seriously hobbled him through much of 1986, 87, and into 1988.
Of course, isn't it still sort of up for speculation whether Reagan was actually in on this?
Well, it is up to speculation, and ironically, one of the reasons why it is in some quarters is that it was entirely believable to some people that Reagan would have no idea. Richard Nixon was, as we know, deeply immersed in everything that took place in the White House. Someone like a Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton were hands-on people. Ronald Reagan was not. Ronald Reagan liked to joke that that he worries about problems in government and has caused him many a sleepless afternoon. So when he denied knowing anything about this, some people actually believed him when he said so. But that was also kind of damning because it showed what a disengaged figure he seemed to be.
Well, your book talks about these flaws that presidents have, often just sort of mistakes they made. How do you weigh this one in terms of Reagan's character or his presidency?
Well, I think it does reveal something essential about Reagan, it reveals, first of all, that he was, in some ways, let some unscrupulous people run the White House, and he was, I think, both his champions and critics would agree, a kind of delegator. He did not show a lot of curiosity about things that he did not care very much about. There were some things that Reagan cared very, very deeply about, and one of those, of course, was U.S. relations with the Soviet Union. And in that case, he really, of course, ultimately achieved great success.
And here you're talking about how you say he made the world a safer place by getting Gorbachev to agree to reduce nuclear weapons in Europe.
Right, and I guess I'm one of those people you talked about in your introduction who was sort of grudging. I mean, I came of age during Reagan's presidency or his accession to the presidency, and for much of my adult life, my young adult life, I was very critical of him. And I was one of a number of people who were deeply worried by Reagan's behavior coming into office. We thought that he was a cowboy, he was a hawk, lots of folks in Europe staged large protests. But Reagan really did have a vision, and this is one of the few places, I think, and maybe this is not a bad thing because presidents can only do so much, where he did have a vision. He really believed that he could bring the Cold War to a close, and he really believed that he could do that from a position of strength. And we know in retrospect, now that the Soviet archives have been opened, that the Soviets were indeed worried and did indeed have difficulty keeping up with Reagan in the early going. But that in itself isn't the whole picture. The other part of it, I think, and I really do focus on this in the book, is that moment at Reykjavik where he meets Gorbachev in 1987 and stuns not only Gorbachev himself, but also his own advisors in terms of trying to make a deal right here, right now, to cut nuclear weapons in half, I think. And Gorbachev is so startled by this that he walks away from the table. But the long-term significance of this is not that there was some kind of gambit or some kind of gamesmanship, but it showed that Reagan really was serious. And eventually, of course, they do reach an agreement to begin lowering actual levels as opposed to lowering the rate of growth. And ultimately, of course, Reagan's larger-term strategy of breaking the Soviet capacity to compete was vindicated. So for me, this was an important chapter, not only in the book, but in my life, in terms of trying to reckon with history as I happen to live it.
I hadn't known about that moment in Reykjavik when Reagan sort of, it sounds like it's almost on a whim, where he's like, you know what, let's get rid of all the nuclear weapons in Europe.
Well,
I mean, you can understand that Gorbachev would be like, what is this guy doing?
Right, and I think that a lot of people at the time thought of it that way, thought of it as Reagan being wildly impulsive or even out of touch, and we know that Reagan did have, you know, some difficulty relating to reality at different points in his life. But one of the things we are aware of, especially since the Reagan Diaries have come to come out, is that he was very, very passionate, very focused, and was very much his own man in terms of articulating his vision. There's a wonderful moment, I think it's Richard Reeves talks about this at Reykjavik, where Reagan's own advisors are saying to him, you couldn't have done that, Mr. President. You couldn't have possibly offered that. And Reagan says, yes, I did, you know, in a very firm voice. So in a funny kind of way, it's a great vindication of that great Phil Hartman Saturday Night Live routine where Reagan sort of kisses children and acts like adults and suddenly snaps into attention and turns into a really focused guy.
So Reagan is just one of the presidents you examine in your book. What were you hoping to discover or learn about America's presidents or what the American people want by your look at imperfect presidents?
Well, I'll tell you how I started, and maybe later I'll tell you how I ended with this. I started because, as you mentioned, I'm a high school teacher, and actually I'm about to reintroduce a course in civics, dust it off, and make it a little less musty. But the thing that concerns me about the way the subject has been taught or thought about is that it seems kind of dull and it seems kind of irrelevant to people's lives. And I think that, you know, we have this kind of polarization that's gone on. And on the one hand, we have this old vision of trying to sort of idealize our leaders and to idealize the American past. And competing with it, we have a kind of counter-narrative of sort of cynicism, so that George Washington of the cherry tree has been replaced by George Washington, the slaveholder. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, has been replaced by Thomas Jefferson, the slaveholder, and the man with his own Monica problem, as it were, in having a relationship with one of his slaves. And what I was hoping to do is to try to balance the picture a little bit, offer more of an integrated vision of these folks, so that young people in particular could approach these people in a way that they seemed recognizably human and make, you know, more informed choices and more realistic choices and be willing to accept limitations even as they strive for, a higher-minded vision of American life.
Well, tell us about one of your favorite or most telling portraits of a president in here.
Well, I'll tell you how the book started for me, and that was when I started the job that I now have, and I was thumbing through a U.S. history textbook, and I noticed a couple of lines in passing in the textbook about how George Washington sort of stared down a coup at the very end of the American Revolution. And this involved the fact that the soldiers hadn't been paid, the officers hadn't paid, creditors hadn't been paid, and there was real talk in the nation's capital, in Philadelphia, that someone really should take a strong hand. And one of these people was Alexander Hamilton, who, of course, is one of the great founding fathers, who's done a lot of things for this country, but who also got involved in some pretty dubious schemes in his life. Mm-hmm. And Washington regarded Hamilton as a kind of surrogate son. And when Hamilton sent Washington this masterpiece of plausible deniability, in which he said someone, wink, wink, needs to take charge, Washington sort of sat on this for weeks without doing anything. The reasons for that are not entirely clear to me, and I must say I really wonder about Washington's judgment in that particular case. But when the thing started to come to light and the plot began to move, Washington swung into action and did some subterfuge of his own, issuing some ambiguous statements that allowed him to attend a meeting he wasn't expected to attend and to give this unforgettable address in which he told his fellow soldiers that they were crazy if they thought this was a time when they should desert the Patriot cause. And at the end of it, he seems to be teared up. He takes out his glasses, which was a big deal, sort of like seeing FDR in a wheelchair. And Washington says, "You'll have to forgive me, gentlemen. I've gone blind in the service of my country," or something to that effect. And this sort of diffuses the whole crisis. Washington, of course, was a great man, and this was a great hour for him, although it's one a lot of people don't know about. It's the prologue for my book because, in some sense, Washington's not turning into the man on horseback, not becoming the Latin American dictator, of which we've seen so many, makes it possible for the other stories in the book to be told.
But you think he did sort of have a crisis of the heart when Hamilton suggested he take over. You think maybe he was considering?
No, I don't think he was considering. I think that Washington was really very, very passionate and very, very principled about this. I think the real problem with Washington's conduct here is that he didn't sort of call out Hamilton and say, "What the hell are you thinking?" And I think part of that, is that he did have that, that very close feeling that the paternal Washington never had a natural born son, and there were a few surrogate sons he had in his life. Lafayette was one. Hamilton, I think, was another. Some people regard during Adams's presidency that he let, for example, Hamilton and Jefferson go at each other for far too long because he didn't want to sort of take a strong hand there. My real point in telling this story is less about trying to diss George Washington, who I really do think, actually I think much more after writing the book, is an even greater man than I thought he was, than it is to sort of set up the fact that he created a space, a set of institutions in which fallible people could govern, could make mistakes, and could ultimately redeem themselves.
We're talking this hour with Jim Cullen. He's the author of the book Imperfect Presidents, Tales of Misadventure and Triumph. And Jim Cullen teaches at the Ethical Culture Fieldston School in New York. What do you think? Who were some of our country's great presidents? And what weaknesses, what Achilles' heels did they have? Did you see them overcome them? What were those defining hours? What do you remember? What sticks in your mind about some of the past presidents from Clinton on down? Call us, won't you, at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can reach us that way. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you this morning on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 11 o'clock, Larry Mueller takes time out for Wisconsin Wildlife. He's joined by UW-Madison and Extension wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. That's coming up on Larry Mueller after 11. And we're back this hour with Jim Cullen. He is the author of Imperfect Presidents. He is a teacher at the Ethical Culture Fieldston School in New York. And we're talking with him about some personal faux pas presidents have made, maybe some character liabilities that they have overcome and in many cases gone on to become great presidents. In other cases, maybe not so much. Jim Cullen, we're back, and we do have a caller for you from San Francisco. Let's take a call from David. Hi, David, go ahead.
Yeah, morning. I was struck when you were talking about Iran-Contra. It reminded me of so many different scandals that were related to it. And one of the greatest disservices that apparently Reagan and Bush did in those years was to get America so deep in debt that it looked like we'd never be able to get out. And some of the aspects of that are still very obvious today. In fact, David Stockman, the president's chief financial officer, so to speak, has been caught in a major scandal up in Detroit in which he's essentially centralized all of the interiors of cars into one company, and then he bankrupted and looted it. So he's apparently trying to destroy America's automakers by centralizing it in that way. But I was interested in specifically the savings and loan scam, and how many of those figures are still involved in American politics today, and they've been allowed to continue. Specifically, I'm thinking one of the major horrors that happened in the savings and loan scam was that about three-quarters of American farmers went under. There were many apartment buildings, houses, boats, all sorts of different things that got seized, but about three-quarters of American farmers went under in those 12 years of Reagan and Bush. And now I'm wondering whether or not they're doing the same thing with the troops. They've taken many of the troops who are National Guard. These are well-educated people, ambulance drivers, police and fire department people all over the country. And then while they're overseas, they pay them this pittance. They help crush the companies that they're and the cities and services that they're locked into, and then whether or not they're foreclosing on their properties after they while they're overseas. Are you familiar with much of the savings and loan scandal and the way in which they crushed this country economically?
Well, I am aware, and certainly in general terms, about the savings and loan scandal, which, of course, didn't really flower in public consciousness until the Bush presidency, I believe, although clearly many of the pieces were in place or in development through the Reagan years. And that, of course, is a blot on the Reagan and Bush administrations and the American political system generally. You mentioned a whole bunch of things there, and I think they're all part of a larger piece of the sort of privatization of the American government, and that's been one of the major themes of the last 30 years or so, and this is something that is very much Reagan's legacy, and I think that many of us believe that that has gone to extremes, particularly in the current administration. So that is something that is sort of worrisome. I would point out, however, two things. One, that to a great extent, however excessive, and clearly the savings and loan scandal and some of the things that have happened to American farmers are excessive, but that Reagan was responding to a powerful sense that traditional liberalism in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s was not exactly functioning terribly well either. And that was really a collective judgment on the part of the American people. And I think that's one of the themes of my book that I really try to emphasize here, is that presidents are symbols and presidents are important. Presidents can only do what they do in a democratic republic as long as public opinion sort of allows them to do so. And that brings up the other point I just mentioned in passing, which is probably a bigger subject than we could take on here, which is a more trans-historical development in all of this. And you do see this in a lot of societies. I mean, I think the Roman Empire, for example, which had a similar sort of dynamic of public-private tension in terms of who was going to pay and who was going to control the functions of government.
This reminds me of something in your book that I thought was striking. Was that you said Reagan sort of rewrote the equations for how politics was done. In fact, he was the one, you said, who sort of brought into the consciousness the idea that big government was bad. I mean, that's sort of still the game plan that Republicans are running on right now.
Right. We very much live in the age of Reagan. I mean, American politics, for better or worse, whether we like it or not, is still functioning on the terms, you know, that Reagan laid down most memorably in his first inaugural, in which he said government is not the solution. Government is the problem. In that regard, I think Reagan is sort of the Andrew Jackson of the 20th century. Andrew Jackson had a similar impact on American politics that lasted after he died. And part of what these people did, I think, and I think it does get us back to this point that we can't simply talk about the individual necessarily as much as it is the way that they embody a kind of collective belief in what constitutes common sense at a given time. You know, Reagan really did define the idea that government was the problem, and we've been living off of that. We've been whether you like it or not, that's the prevailing climate in which we've lived ever since.
Why was he able to do that?
Well, I think he was able to do that, first of all, for reasons that had absolutely nothing to do with him, in the sense that the traditional liberalism, as it had been, you know, sort of codified by Franklin Roosevelt, another figure, of course, and someone important in Reagan's own life and shaping his own identity, especially as a young man, had been consolidated under Truman, had been expanded under Johnson, had, in some sense, run its course. And, you know, the economy of the late 1960s and early 1970s began to stagnate. People began to get frustrated with government. They felt that it was excessively onerous in terms of regulation and so on. So that's sort of one part of the story. I'm not necessarily saying people were right to feel that way or that everybody felt that way, but that was sort of the emerging feeling that Reagan was able to tap. Reagan was able to succeed, I think, and of course a lot of other people think, because he was able to sort of articulate that frustration, but simultaneously he was able to offer a hopeful, optimistic, cheerful vision of the American future at a time of a real crisis of confidence in the way the country was going. So those are the sort of two halves of the walnut, to use a Harry Truman metaphor, that allowed Reagan to become as successful as he was, both in his time and afterward.
Well, I guess that idea of big government being bad, even when some people say that Republicans now are running bigger government than we've seen in ages, why is that such a hard nut for the liberals to crack? Why has it endured?
Well, I think, I mean, one commonly given answer to that question is that conservatives use their time in the wilderness very well, that during the Truman years, during the Johnson years, they were on the outs, but that they built an intellectual infrastructure that involved think tanks and publications and developing television personalities and so on, that allowed them to sort of articulate their message. The other part of that, I think, is that Americans, I think, always are ambivalent about government, but it's often a question of what the big government is for. Republicans almost always are in favor of big government when it involves defense. Mm. Liberals are almost always in favor of big government when it involves almost anything else. and we tend to lose sight of that and just sort of speak in the shorthand of big government or limited government, which can obscure as much as it reveals.
We'll go back to the presidents and the phones now. Thank you for the call, David. And we go to Bob in Darlington. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Hello, Bob. Are you?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
I think that Theodore Roosevelt was a wonderful president. That he really doesn't get a lot of credit for all of the wonderful things that he set up for the nation. You know, including the Panama Canal and conservation programs. He stopped the J.P. Morgan and all of these characters from really dominating the country at that time. He says, America's not for you guys. It isn't just for you. It's for the American people.
Hmm.
And
so you think he hasn't been given his due?
To a certain extent, but yet I think that it should be a little stronger push towards the wonderful things that he did. Oh, and there's also a wonderful park in my home state of North Dakota called the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Beautiful.
Hmm.
And so...
Well, I certainly agree with the caller. In fact, I do have a chapter on Roosevelt in my book, and I do think that he was one of those maybe half dozen figures that I would include with someone like Reagan or someone like Jackson, who really did define the spirit of a time during and after his presidency and really did rewrite the equation. Roosevelt was certainly a big government man by just about any standard, both in terms of defense and in terms of public welfare, and in that regard was pretty unusual, even unique.
Well, thank you to Bob for that call. And we do have a couple of open lines for you right now. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And share your thoughts about the imperfect presidents. Is there a president you think that perhaps was flawed, but that you consider a great president? Call us with your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. We take a call now from Al in La Crosse. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Well, the thing I disagree with Reagan is that, and the whole premise here of the author is that somehow there's this magical world out there where the public actually knows what's going on and therefore can make a rational, informed decision and therefore can have a part in the political process and therefore influence who's president or what their actions are. But, you know, I was in Nicaragua when Ronald Reagan and had friends who were murdered there by Contras while Ronald Reagan was denying that there was such a thing as a Contra. You know, I had friends who were in Cambodia when Richard Nixon was denying that we had invaded Cambodia. You know, now we have the secrecy around the vice presidency and other actions in the president's office, and we also have a control of the press that, for example, this latest CIA revealing here of their actions back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, such that 40s maybe too early, it was a different organization. But anyway, when they revealed this, you know, I happened to call the La Crosse paper, and the paper said, first person said, the editor said they didn't even know anything about it, despite all their press feeds. And the second editor said, well, you know, it's old news. So if you're a president and you successfully control the press and control the output, at least can muddy the water so you can't clearly see what's at the bottom in the muck, and you can get it to hold off for 25 or 30 or 35 years, the general perception is going to be like, well, that stuff isn't happening today. That's old news. Why cover it? You know, I mean, it's not significant. Things have moved on, so forth and so on. And so we never learn our lessons from what happened. And consequently, that whole factor that you mentioned and alluded to before about, you know, people having decisions and the sign of the times and we're involved and so forth and so on, and the president reflects the will of the people, to me, that's really kind of baloney because, you know, there's so much manipulation of the information sources and information and distortion of what does come out that it really becomes, I mean, I'm not cynical about participating. I participate a lot. Obviously, I wouldn't have picked up the phone and called. But at the same time, there is this idea somehow that's overblown that these guys are actually listening to us and that somehow they're not controlling the information source that we get in conjunction with, you know, big corporations and whatever. So I just think it has to be revisited and relooked at when it comes to analyzing what presidents do, how they get away with stuff, and why this information is not fed out there to us in a form that you actually would feel like picking up the phone and calling somebody or going to some organization or putting money somewhere or whatever and actually having a voice that's actually going to make a difference. I think that's why people don't vote.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Al. What do you think, Jim Cullen?
Well, I think that, you know, the caller had a lot to say, and I think he makes a lot of important points. I do think that, you know, secrecy is the enemy of democracy, and that not the less information people have, the worse things that are going to tend to take place. And certainly, I can understand from both the personal and ideological reasons why he would have deep ongoing reservations about the presidency of someone like Ronald Reagan, as indeed do I. I would, however, point out a couple of things here. One is that that in any kind of government system, in any kind of life situation, really, we never have complete information. We always have to work with an incomplete set of data when we're evaluating a candidate, when we're evaluating a policy, when we're choosing a spouse, whatever. But that given that very real limitation, we can often pretty much figure out the general outlines of what we're getting. I'm willing to bet, for example, that caller had deep reservations about Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan long before a lot of this news ever did come out. Conversely, a lot does come out. I mean, the McClatchy newspapers, for example, the newspaper chain, has been reporting on the Bush administration for years and years. It's not like this information isn't getting out. It is getting out. A lot of people just simply don't want to hear it or aren't paying attention. So while I don't want to sort of minimize the real problems of censorship, the real problems of secrecy, the real crimes that take place behind closed doors, I do think one of the conclusions I've drawn sort of from studying the presidency is that you often get a pretty good idea of who you're dealing with pretty early on in the process, even if you don't know the specific details of what they're likely to do.
You do say at the end of your book that it doesn't matter so much who the president is, it matters who the people are. And I would certainly back that 100%, say maybe in the election era of FDR. But what about today when candidates are packaged and processed and spun so that it's really hard to tell, you know, one thing from another?
Well, it is hard to tell, although I have to confess that I do believe that anybody who is really paying attention usually can tell something. We knew an awful lot about George Bush's personality in 2000, even if we didn't know, you know, some of the stuff that go on, even though none of us knew what was going to happen with September 11th. We knew his philosophy of government, and he sort of acted on that to a very great extent. We've known that he's a very personable guy, and that has continued to be the case, even as, you know, three-quarters of us, you know, have concluded that he's a bad president. You know, there are tipping points. There are contingencies. The election of 2000, no one could have predicted it was going to be so close. And, you know, George Bush, of course, lost that election from a popular standpoint. But he did get close enough. He did manage to command about that 49% or so. So, you know, the people did matter here because about half of them, you know, some proportion, right around a half of them, you know, did choose him. And when you have that unfortunate contingent historical event, you know, that's enough to put you over the top. That's exceptional. That's only happened a couple other times in American history. But, you know, we do have accidents. Sometimes we have negative accidents, like many of us would feel is the case with the election of 2000. And once in a while we get positive accidents, with like Abraham Lincoln getting 39% of the vote in 1860.
So you're still a believer.
I'm still a believer. You know, I'm a chastened believer. I'm a worried believer, but I'm a believer.
Well, let's go back to the phones, and here's a call from Wayne in Holman. Welcome, Wayne. You're on the air. Hello, Wayne. Are you there? Hello.
Good morning, and happy 4th of July to both of you.
Happy 4th to you, too.
Isn't it great to live in America? Quick question. First, I wanted to tweak the liberals by saying God bless this country. I think it's the greatest country in the world, but I also want to come to the defense of Ronald Reagan a little bit. I was kind of hoping this wouldn't turn into a trash Reagan hour, but I thought he brought this country up from depths of despair. I thought he helped give the company some thoughts for hope for the future, and that we are a good people and that we can accomplish many good things. I don't think that he deserves the kind of treatment he's getting. I mean, the man is in the ground. I think he deserves a lot of kudos and respect. I know liberals hate him. You can hear it today even. The seething hatred for Bush and Reagan is appalling to me, but it exists. So maybe we could kind of concentrate on other presidents as well, not just Republicans, and maybe kind of be a little bit more fair in our analysis of who Reagan was and lives in our hearts. I know he did many things wrong, but I think he did a lot of darn good things, too. So anyway, have a nice day and peace to all of you.
Back at you, Wayne.
Thank you.
You know, I don't know if Wayne heard the beginning of the hour. We did talk about how a big tenet of your chapter about Reagan is how he did make the world a safer place. And he truly was committed to reducing the nuclear arsenal. And he did that.
He did, and I think it's sort of. I mean, you can make lots of different arguments about that. In fact, one of the points I very quickly hastened to add in my own case is that Reagan didn't do it alone. I mean, Gorbachev did it, Pope John Paul did it, the great people of Poland who formed the Solidarity Movement. They all did it too. We don't want to necessarily turn this into a Ronald Reagan thing alone. It clearly was not. But Reagan did have a role to play, and he played that role positively. And I think those of us who disagreed with him in many, many ways, and I certainly am one of them, you know, owe it to the spirit of the discourse to acknowledge even whatever the man did wrong, this was something I think that he got right. You know, Wayne talked about that spirit of optimism. I tried to explain a little bit about that earlier. Reagan was not alone in that regard. Other presidents have done that. I think the earlier caller talked about Theodore Roosevelt. He also inspired a sense of confidence in the future. Thomas Jefferson in 1800 did the same thing. Some people feel that way about John F. Kennedy in terms of inspiring Americans to their better selves. That's an important function, I think, of the presidency, and Reagan was one of a number of people who succeeded on that basis for a great many people.
We're talking with this hour with Jim Cullen. He's the author of the book Imperfect Presidents, Tales of Misadventure and Triumph. He's also the author of the book Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen and the American Tradition. What do you think? Who were some of the great presidents, and did they have liabilities? What about Bill Clinton? What about Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln? If you've thought about it, this is the time to give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We do have an open phone line for you. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 11 o'clock today, Larry Mueller takes time out for Wisconsin Wildlife. He's joined by UW-Madison and Extension wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. And then at 12:30, we'll hear Jim Fleming reading from Jimi Hendrix Turns 80, a comic novel by Tim Sandlin. I'm Veronica Rickert, back with you in for Kathleen Dunn today here on the Ideas Network. And we're talking about the presidents of the recent past and the distant past with Jim Cullen. He's the author of Imperfect Presidents, Tales of Misadventure and Triumph. And Jim Cullen, why don't we look at one of the other presidents in your book? There are, I think, about 11 profiles in there. What about Clinton? It seems pretty obvious what Clinton's liabilities were, right?
Well, I think virtually everyone listening to the show lived through the Clinton presidency and has a pretty good sense of what Bill Clinton's possibilities and limits were. I think he was one of those people that had a lot of charisma, that did give people some sense of optimism. He certainly was a believer in government, although he was chastened, I think, like a lot of people were, about its limits living in the shadow of Reagan. But his personal life certainly was a factor. Some folks think it was an irrelevant factor. Other folks, and I must say I'm one of them, who think it was a relevant factor, even if, at least for a lot of the time, I thought Clinton did more good things than bad.
And you say that it wasn't maybe so much his infidelities, but the fact that they led him to try to appease Hillary, and Hillary in turn wanted him to try to push through certain policy.
Right. I'm one of those people that believe that that Clinton made some of the choices he did in his public life based on what was going on in his private life. And I'm looking specifically at the health care plan of 1993, which, of course, didn't work out very well. There was a real argument going on in the White House at the beginning of Clinton presidency about what his priority should be, whether it should be health care, whether it should be welfare reform. There was a bit of an internecine struggle between Vice President Gore and the First Lady. And ultimately, Clinton went with the First Lady, and ultimately he put her in charge of it. I think that there are some folks, David Gergen being one of them, who believe that he made that choice basically because this was around the time of the sort of whole Paula Jones fiasco, and that in some sense he felt obligated to do this for Hillary because his behavior had required him to do some form of payback. And that, of course, did not turn out very well. And I think that it's hard to avoid a conclusion, at least on my part, that had something to do with it.
And you say in this chapter on Clinton that at the end of the day, you don't think he is going to be considered a great president. And I assume that's because of these.
That's part of it. But it's also a matter of, I think, presidents, you know, I use this word contingency, an element of chance. I mean, you know, Clinton was not president of the United States on September 11th. He was not president of the United States on December 7th, 1941. So, you know, he didn't have the opportunity to do things that he otherwise might have. So his personal behavior was a problem. When he arrived in office was a problem. And I do think, again, that he was not able to really substantially change the equation that Reagan had established. I mean, I think it's one of the more interesting things about the Clinton presidency, for example, that his vice president, Al Gore, led a major initiative on reinventing government and sort of privatizing certain functions. I don't think we think of Al Gore as a Reagan-esque figure. I don't think Al Gore thinks of himself as a Reagan-esque figure. But he was willing to absorb what people would call the lessons of the Reagan equation and implement them, you know, during a Democratic administration. So I don't think that, you know, that Clinton was the transformative figure that he and perhaps others would have liked him to have been.
What about the charisma factor? Like Reagan, this was a guy who had a lot of charisma and he got in a lot of trouble. And still, there are a lot of people out there today who are still unabashed Clinton devotees.
Well, that's right, and of course, charisma does go a long way, although it isn't everything. And I think a lot of folks would say that the current president, sort of illustrates that point. But in Clinton's case, I think there is another factor at work, which is that so much of Clinton's charisma derived from his astonishing sense of competence and mastery, and he was sort of overwhelming in terms of his command of policy and his political instincts. And so his charisma was very different, say, than Reagan's charisma, which was a sort of a folksy charm. Instead, it was the charisma of a whiz kid. And I think that's a dynamic that's peculiar to Clinton himself.
Let's go back to the phones now and take a call from Robert in Stevens Point.
Hello. Yes. Yeah, this is less about problems of a sitting president so much as it's a problem experienced by that political problem experienced by that politician before he became a president. But mm-hmm. I'm aware that when Abraham Lincoln was still a congressman, he made some speech in opposition to the war in Mexico that was costly to his costing his seat in Congress, and yet later he was able to function as a wartime president. I mean, is there anything? Are there any lessons he learned from that earlier negative experience?
Are you familiar with that speech, Jim Cullen?
Yes, I am. I think it was an important event in Lincoln's life. But just to review for some of our viewers, Lincoln gets elected to Congress in 1846, and he arrives in 1847, just as the Mexican War gets underway. And there's a kind of Gulf of Tonkin moment at that point about why the Mexican War is getting underway. President Polk says shots are fired, and he doesn't really sort of specify where. And Lincoln goes out and gives a speech on the floor of Congress demanding to know exactly where these shots were fired. Was it in Mexican territory? Was it in American territory? And so on. And Lincoln goes on to sort of have his own John Kerry moment in which he supports the troops and votes for the funding but comes out against the war. Which it politically proves to be a mistake because the voters back in Illinois support the war. And Lincoln does not run for re-election, but as part of a very complicated scheme that he had made with some of his fellow Republicans in the 1840s. But the important point is that he lost the seat to Democrats. So this was not a happy moment in Lincoln's career. The caller asks if Lincoln sort of learned from that. I'm not aware of any particular diary entry, and of course Lincoln did write a lot, saying, you know, I really regret having done that. But I do think one of the things we do see about Lincoln was an astonishing capacity for political calibration and an ability to sort of know which way the political winds were blowing and to navigate them, not necessarily to blow with the wind, but to know when to act. And I do think that he probably learned from that experience, and it's what made him so successful when he did things like issue the Emancipation Proclamation or when he issued the Gettysburg Address or when he wrote the Second Inaugural. I think that this was an acute consciousness of where the people were and his ability to sort of work with that is one of the hallmarks of Lincoln's greatness.
You talk about Lincoln overcoming some of what you would consider his liabilities in his decision to free the slaves, and you consider this something that came about from religion, from a spiritual standpoint for Lincoln.
Yeah, you know, one of the things we think of about Reagan's presidency is that he ushered in a sort of a spirit of social and religious conservatism. And I guess, you know, you might argue that wind blew over American historiography as well. There have been a number of writers who have really focused in recent years on Lincoln's religiosity. And I myself do think that Abraham Lincoln was a very spiritual man, at least at the end of his life. At the beginning of his life was a different story. You know, he was born into a Baptist family, but a hard shell Baptist family, a Calvinist Baptist family. And as a young man, he used to make fun of preachers. He would entertain his siblings by mocking them and sort of impersonating them after church on Sunday. And this became a problem for him because he, as I talk about in the book, you know, sort of challenged a local Methodist preacher named Peter Cartwright, who ultimately ran for Congress. And Lincoln went to his campaign events and sort of challenged him. Ultimately, Lincoln ran against Cartwright, and Cartwright used Lincoln's supposed atheism against him. And Lincoln responded to that with this masterpiece, again, of plausible deniability, in which he said he would never vote for an open enemy of religion, the key word being open, although that sort of, you know, sort of skated over that. But to make a long story short, when Lincoln becomes presidency and presides over the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, it tends, I think, to focus the mind about larger things. And an element of spiritual vision, and I think very much as Calvinist upbringing begins to sort of reassert itself, and you really see that very vividly, I think, in, you know, the Second Inaugural, in which he really sees God's hand at work in the Civil War, and that it's a punishment to North and South for the sin of slavery. You know, in the book, I talk about, you know, different mistakes that people make, and sometimes it's a function of their characters, and sometimes it's a function of violating their truest selves. In Lincoln's case, I think the transformation was reconnecting with the earliest sources of his ideological and moral vision.
Although there are a lot of people who say that it wasn't so much a spiritual thing for Lincoln, that it was simply a desire at all costs and above everything else to hold the Union together.
Right. You know, but one of the interesting things about that is why Lincoln was so obsessed with the Union. One of his old friends, who ultimately became vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stephens, you know, once complained that for Lincoln, you know, this idea of Union had a kind of religious mysticism about it. He couldn't understand why it was Union, Union, Union. And I think when you look at a lot of Lincoln's writings, it's because he really believed that the United States was a great place, and that it was a moral place, and that slavery was such a problem here because, not only because it was morally wrong, but because it corrupted otherwise good people from realizing their dreams. And you know, I think that so much of Lincoln's hopes for his countries were bound up in that vision, which increasingly I think had an avowedly religious cast. And you see this even in Lincoln's private writings, in which he talks about the will of God. This is not something that you see very much in his early writings, but becomes a real motif as you get closer to the end of his life.
Hmm. Well, let's take it back to the phones now. And here's a call from Yvonne in Appleton. Hi, Yvonne.
Good morning.
Morning.
First, it's really interesting to hear some of the details that some of us might not know about, presidents in past history. But I want to bring it back to current presidents or more recent presidents and our current culture of how when the cameras are going constantly during a presidential appearance, they're bound to catch someone with sort of a stupid expression on his face or, looking goofy. And I think particularly that the late President Gerald Ford, suffered from that because, the cameras caught him stumbling as he was coming off of an airplane. And then, Chevy Chase turned that into a whole shtick. And actually, the man was an athlete. Wasn't he a football star for Michigan?
He was. He was recruited to the pros, but he turned down the Packers, I think, and the Lions to go to law school.
You can't be a clumsy fool. But it was just the cameras caught him at some unguarded moment, and they're bound to, and there he is forever, remembered as this clumsy dolt. And actually, he was a very intelligent man and probably a good athlete as well.
Mm. Well, I think there's an important point that you're making there, that there are distortions that take place and that we sometimes really misunderstand things about people. I mean, one of the things where people like Reagan and Eisenhower, we now know, were far more thoughtful than we thought they were at the time. Gerald Ford, I think, is a very interesting case, and in fact, I do have a chapter in the book on him in which I talk about his mistake and his vindication, in some sense, being the same thing, and that is the pardon of Nixon, which I think was probably the right thing to do, although he went about it the wrong way. And I think this is sort of relevant to the point that the caller brings up, because Gerald Ford was not a clumsy man. He was actually a rather graceful man physically. But in other senses, I do think he was kind of clumsy. He did not have a great deal of charisma. He did have a kind of plodding style. And he was perceived to be, especially in economic questions, for example, to be quite plodding. And so this notion of a stumbler made a lot of sense metaphorically, even if it didn't make a whole lot of sense in terms of what the record actually shows about his equilibrium, walking across a stage or off a plane.
Thanks for the call, Yvonne. And we'll take one now from Paul in Viroqua. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that Bill Clinton is one of the most political presidents we've ever had, one of the most plotting presidents, and I offer two mistakes that he made as examples of that. One is, they're going to impeach me. What can I do to stop this? Let's bomb Iraq. And it was obvious. And then the second one is when he's signing the welfare reform bill, and this is a big thing that the Republicans wanted done. He signs it, and he says, don't worry, we'll change this in enforcement. And I see those both as, they're a moment of triumph for him. Ultimately, they're mistakes.
Well, the caller mentions the bombing of Iran. I think Clinton did that in 93. He may be referring to the bombing of Sudan in 1998, I believe, that ultimately killed those children in the pharmaceutical factory, if I'm not mistaken. And I think the idea was that Osama bin Laden might have been there, and Clinton was not sure whether to go ahead, and he did. And I disagree with the caller in some respects, although I think it does get back to this point that Clinton's private behavior did have public consequences, because this all happened during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and Clinton really was concerned that it would be perceived as a way of distracting things. And, in fact, it was perceived that way, and I think reasonable people like the caller could come to that conclusion. So I don't necessarily put the same dark spin on it that the caller does, but I understand where he's coming from, and I do think that, you know, that private behavior really does have public consequences, and that's a particularly good example of the principle at work.
And that was a time when people were thinking wag the dog, and that did gain a lot of public momentum, didn't it?
It did. You know, the caller mentions that Clinton is very political. I think that's certainly true. I mean, everything was calculated in Clinton's presidency, including where he went on vacation, the famous example that Dick Morris, he was advising him. But to call a president political is a little like calling a kettle black. I mean, they're all political to a greater or less degree. And when they're not political, like Gerald Ford in the Nixon case, they really suffer for it. I mean, two of some of the least politically minded recent presidents in American history are Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, who were probably two of the nicest men to ever occupy the Oval Office and probably two of the most unsuccessful men to ever hold the job.
Well, I think we have to leave it there. Jim Cullen, thank you so much for your time this morning. I appreciate it, and I hope you have a wonderful 4th of July.
My best to all the residents of the Badger State. Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jim Cullen is the author of Imperfect Presidents and also Born in the USA. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, who produced this hour. If you'd like a copy, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program 74D. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.